In 1982, a patrol officer pulled over a young woman for speeding. He forced her to have sex before killing her. He then used his 10 years of police experience to cover up his crime and convince detectives of her innocence. Will he be able to fool her? Twenty-three-year-old Robin Bishop had traveled from Las Vegas to visit a friend in Los Angeles. Robin hoped to become an actress. Her friend told her that if she was really determined, she should consider moving to Los Angeles. Robin headed back to Las Vegas to make plans for her move. She was excited about the changes that were coming. In Barstow, California, she stopped to call her mother and grab a sandwich. On her way back to her car, she was spotted by patrolman George Waltney. This police officer, respected by his colleagues and friends, actually had a troubled past. He stopped women for speeding. If they responded to his advances, he promised not to give them a ticket. That's what happened that evening, January 11, 1982. He memorized the make and model of the young woman's car. He also noticed that it had a Nevada license plate. Then he spotted a boy he knew from the neighborhood. He could use him as an alibi. He let Preston Olson get into his car and offered to drive him home. He dropped Preston off and greeted his parents. By now, the young woman who had spotted him had probably left town. He headed toward Nevada on Highway 15. This highway was less busy than usual. He caught up with a young woman east of Barstow. He turned on his lights and siren to get her to pull over. Robin Bishop had had several speeding tickets. She was finishing her year of probation and had been given a warning. The next time she was caught speeding, her license would be revoked. Without a car or a driver's license, Robin would have a hard time making it as an actress in Los Angeles. She left her keys in the ignition and her purse in the car. Robin was probably surprised to be asked to get into the patrol car, but she complied. Unfortunately, he had other plans than to give her a ticket. He held her still while he handcuffed her. He then made her sit in the back seat. The young woman was probably scared and confused. Why had the officer handcuffed her, and where was he taking her? Walton went back to the young woman's car to get her purse. At that moment, a motorist passed him. Walton grabbed the purse, returned to his car, and drove off, leaving the young woman's car on the shoulder of the highway. He exited via a ramp that led to a rarely used lane. This lane ran parallel to the highway. He used to take it when he had a break. From this secluded vantage point, he could see 400 feet of highway in every direction. After threatening Robin with taking her driver's license and having her imprisoned, he raped her. When he was done, he called the police station to report an abandoned car on the highway. He knew that a motorist had seen him approaching Robin's car. Then, he drove onto the access road to get closer to Robin's car.
Yeah.
He removed her sunglasses and helped her get out of the patrol car. For Waltney, the plan was working like clockwork. He had gotten what he wanted and was about to let her go. But just as she sat on the ground and was about to put her boots back on, something happened. Now that he had released her, perhaps anger replaced fear? Perhaps she threatened to turn him in? His brother was a prosecutor in Nevada. It would be his word against the patrolman's. Then, as the officer stood against his car, he was suddenly illuminated by the headlights of a passing policeman. This officer had probably seen Waltney's car from the highway. Waltney didn't know if he had been recognized. Suddenly, Robin's threats seemed more and more plausible. How could he explain that he was on that driveway? Panicked, Officer George Galti decided to put Robin down forever. He killed her. It was now too late to turn back. Waltney quickly devised a plan. He contacted the police station and reported a body, possibly the victim of suicide. He knew he had only a few minutes before the officers arrived. He searched under the girl's head for the bullet that had killed her. If that clue fell into the hands of the authorities, he would surely be finished. Unfortunately, the bullet had not come out. Detective Milrose of the San Bernardino Police Department was dispatched to the scene to investigate the body discovered by Officer Waltney. On the way to the crime scene, the dispatcher at the police station asked him to examine the abandoned car at the same time. Since the body was a short distance from the driveway, there was every reason to believe that the vehicle and the body were connected. There were no obvious signs of any mechanical problems. The tires were all in good condition. The vehicle was in perfect working order. The key was in the ignition. I did not understand why the vehicle was there. Officer Waltney had had time to regain his composure. He described how he had found the victim. He had taken his hand and searched his purse for identification. The name on the driver's license was Robin Bishop. She was the owner of the abandoned vehicle discovered earlier. Officer Waltnett stated that he believed it was a suicide, but Detective Rose immediately ruled that out. The victim had been shot in the back of the head at close range and then moved. There was a trail of blood on the ground about 3 inches from his head. This was clearly a homicide. The ground was damp from recent rain. Tire and shoe prints were clearly visible. The first officer on the scene criticized Waltnett for leaving a large number of prints. The crime scene had been contaminated. Unusually, Officer Waltnett had been negligent. Upon further examination, I noticed marks on the victim's door handles. Police officers are familiar with these types of injuries. Two hand marks on the top of the wrists and another below. Ooh. These are the marks left by Monot. Examining the contents of the young woman's purse, Rose noticed that nothing had been stolen. However, her identification was on top, as if she had shown them to someone and quickly put them back in her purse. A police officer, or at least someone posing as a law enforcement officer, was involved in this homicide. Only friends or colleagues of Waltney were present at the crime scene. At this point, no one believed he was involved in the crime. An autopsy was performed. The results confirmed that the victim had been moved slightly after the shooting and that the injuries to her wrists had been caused by machetes. The fatal bullet had become lodged in Robin's jaw. It was the same caliber as the bullets used by the police, but a different brand. The autopsy also determined that the victim had had sexual intercourse in the 24 hours before her death, but there was no evidence that she had been raped.
The first thing we had to do was eliminate anyone who had been near the crime scene from our list.
To outwit the police, Waltney had to stay one step ahead of them. When he finished his shift, he quickly removed the barrel from his revolver. Next was the definitive proof of his involvement in the murder. Waltney knew from experience that the barrel had left identifiable marks on the bullet that had killed Robin Bishop. The next morning, he went to a gunsmith to buy a new barrel. That way, ballistics experts would not be able to prove his guilt by analyzing his weapon. But the part was not in stock and had to be ordered. Waltney then had his uniform cleaned and brought his holster to be holstered. All he could do was stall for time and hope the gunsmith would get the gun as soon as possible. In Barstow, Rose organized a meeting between the various police departments to discuss the investigation. He asked all officers on duty at the time of the murder to turn in their weapons to the ballistics department so that they could analyze them and eliminate them from the list of potential suspects. Waltney was at the meeting when he learned the bullet had been found. By the end of the day, he was the only officer who had not yet turned in his firearm. The detectives went to his house to ask for it. Waltney returned empty-handed. He told them that his house had probably been burglarized. The gun was missing. The officer's statements were suspect, but since Galtney was a respected police officer, Detective Brian English of the St. Bernardino Police Department was inclined to believe him. I had some empathy for him. We were actually trying to eliminate him as a suspect. To us, it was a criminal who had committed this murder, not a police officer. Waltney agreed to go to headquarters for questioning Alekunen. The detectives also searched his locker, but his firearm was missing. Two days had passed since Robin Bishop's murder. Waltney's missing gun and his strange behavior had aroused the investigators' suspicions. The agency was read his constitutional rights. He was the prime suspect in this murder case. But there was still not enough evidence to arrest him, Jean. Waltney maintained that he was innocent. He agreed to have the interview recorded. He stated that on January 11th, he was on patrol on the highway as usual. After his meal, he had seen young Preston Olson walking home. He had put him in his car and dropped him off at his home around 8:50 p.m. At 9:15 p.m., he found the abandoned car, ran the usual checks to see if it was stolen. Then he drove up the driveway. He then saw a shape in the darkness and stopped. It was the body of the victim, Robin Bishop. These reactions were not consistent with those of someone who had just been accused of a crime. If I were him, I would have demanded proof of my guilt. I would have been very angry. Officer Waltney immediately asked to take a polygraph test. He was finally given one. He had to answer several questions, the most important of which was, had he killed Robin Bishop?
The analyst was
unable to prove that the officer had lied. In this obstacle course, Waltney had just gained the lead again.
We drove George DeBarto to San Bernardino to question him again. It was at this point that he consented to our searching his residence.
The officer searched for evidence of the Waltney's break-in, but there was no sign of forced entry. Homicide detectives began their work. At dawn, they discovered the frame of a Smith & Wesson Model 19.357 caliber revolver inside Gwaltney's van. The frame was damaged. There were tool marks. The gun appeared to have been disassembled by someone with little knowledge of the subject.
The barrel that was to be used for ballistics testing was missing. Therefore, no analysis could be performed.
The gun was registered to George Michael Gwaltney. There was only one explanation for the disassembly of the gun. Wallen was placed under arrest. But the evidence was circumstantial. The tools used to disassemble the gun now had to be found. The detective searched Gwaltney's residence again. They collected pliers and a vise from behind the garage, which had fresh metal marks on them. They had been used recently. In the bedroom closet, detectives found five boxes of ammunition bearing the police logo. Among the ammunition were 27 Remington 357 caliber bullets and the same make of the bullet that had killed Robin Bishop.
Gwaltney.
Wife was in shock. She didn't believe any of this. During questioning, she said her husband was acting the same as usual. He was a good father and a good husband. The news of the officer's arrest shook the people of Barstow. His colleagues had known and respected him for decades. Despite the evidence against Gwaltney, he couldn't believe he was guilty. Even the investigators had a hard time coming to terms with the possibility.
My gut feeling was that he hadn't done it, that it was impossible since he was a patrol officer.
But the evidence continued to mount. Traces of semen were found on the back seat of Gwaltney's police car and on Robin's jeans. Officer Roger Kaufman filed a crucial report. He had been out of town for a few days and had just heard the news of Gwaltney's arrest. He had driven by the exact location of the crime scene at the time of the murder. From the highway, he had seen the headlights of a car on the small side road. He had turned his spotlight on the car and then spotted a police officer standing next to the vehicle. Unfortunately, he was driving too fast to identify him. A few minutes later, he had heard Gwaltney on the radio reporting a suicide. He had been surprised to hear Gwaltney's agitated voice, because Gwaltney was known for his coolness. He had not thought about it again until he heard the news of his arrest. As the investigation progressed, it became apparent that Gwaltney had used his experience to prevent detectives from gathering evidence against him. His uniform had been cleaned and his holster had been withheld under the pretense that an inspection was due soon. Any traces of human tissue or blood on the weapon had been wiped clean. Additionally, his footprints had contaminated the scene. Detectives interviewed gun shop owners in the area to see if Gwaltney had attempted to replace the barrel of his service revolver. No one recalled seeing him in his shop. After several months of internal investigation, Gwaltney was dismissed from his patrol officer duties. Detectives were now convinced that he had committed this heinous crime, although they were still unable to prove that the officer was lying. Furthermore, he had the support of his wife and friends. 9 months later, the trial began. Although the evidence against Gwaltney was circumstantial, prosecutor Betty Kennedy hoped he would be indicted quickly. In his opening statement, defense attorney George Porter told the jury that George Michael Gwaltney was the victim of a conspiracy, possibly by someone who worked in the same police department as him. Someone had arrested Robin Bishop, as he would demonstrate, but it was not George Gwaltney. The defense presented a railroad worker as a witness. Dennis Gobbler had seen Robin Bishop's car on the highway that evening. There was a light-colored car parked about 20 yards behind it. Gobbler described to the jury a man with a flashlight approaching Bishop's car. His description did not match Goldney's. The defense attorney asked that investigators look for new suspects. For his part, the prosecutor had reconstructed the events of January 11 from Robin, a Sasser's last call to Barstow to Waltney's radio call when he discovered the body. All of Galtney's known actions had been included in this reconstruction, which also gave the police the time needed to commit the murder. The prosecution was convinced that they had a solid case. Everything had been calculated, including the routes taken, including the walk with young Olson, the officer who had seen Gwaltney, and the radio communications. But the defense attorney Posta called dozens of witnesses, colleagues, and friends of the defendant. All spoke of Gwaltney's impeccable past. The attorney even used the reconstruction of events filed by the prosecution to cast doubt on some of these events. How could his client have committed all of the charges in such a short period of time? The defense had no trouble disputing the validity of the scientific analyses of the semen samples collected from the car and from the victim. DNA testing would not be accepted in court for another 6 years. Additionally, Porter Parvin cast doubt on the tool mark analysis, the gun frame, and the tools seized from Goldney's vehicle and residence. Nevertheless, the prosecution hoped that the projectile and disassembled gun would be enough to convince the jury.
The most important piece of evidence we had was the gun frame. How could it possibly be in his vehicle? Why had the gun been disassembled? And why were the barrel missing? The stock, the hammer, and the trigger?
Waltney had it all figured out. He was impeccable. He provided the defense with its best witness himself.
He had the answers to all the questions. And his answers were consistent. The defense's tactic was to cast doubt on all the evidence presented against him. And that's what the attorney did. George did an excellent job testifying.
Despite the 50 witnesses from 30 fields of expertise who had testified, the evidence against Galti failed to convince the jury. After 4 days of deliberation, the trial was adjourned for lack of unanimity. 8 of the 12 jurors favored acquittal. George Gwaltney was a free man.
Nothing is ever certain. You never know which way the jury will lean and what evidence the judge will accept or reject. I had not followed the trial closely, so I was very surprised to learn that George had been acquitted.
The prosecutor, however, was still convinced of Waltney's guilt and refused to give up. Less than a year after the adjournment, Waltney was summoned to appear in Superior Court. But there was little new evidence. The trial was adjourned again. This time, this juror favored acquittal. George Waltney escaped justice again.
We were convinced that George had killed this woman and that we should convict him of what he had done.
The judge denied the prosecutor's request for a retrial, ruling that it was harassment. Since Waltney's arrest, the FBI had been following the case with interest. When a homicide involves a police officer, the FBI has a mandate to monitor the investigation. After Galtney's second acquittal, the public mounted pressure to find Robin Bishop's killer.
Wow.
Agents from the FBI's Los Angeles office decided it was time for them to step in. George Waltney would never again be able to stand trial in California for Robin Bishop's murder. But in federal court, he might be charged with violating the young woman's civil rights. Antoine Robin Bishop, while in the line of duty, George Galti had violated federal law. He had violated her civil rights. A homicide in progress had never been presented like this before, but the FBI and the federal prosecutor were convinced that the case presented an ideal opportunity to do so. The investigation was assigned to Special Agent Michael Rondoff.
Waltney was like the wolf in the sheepfold. The investigators had no idea that the perpetrator was among them. They always managed to stay one step ahead of them by eliminating clues. That's why the investigators had failed to charge him. They didn't know who they were dealing with.
Agent Randolph carefully examined the crime scene photographs. One of them caught his attention. It was a photo of the contents of the trunk of Galtney's police car the night of the murder. He noticed a small box of ammunition. He sent the photos to the lab to have them enlarged and examined.
The FBI lab informed us after analyzing the photos that this was a box of 357 caliber Magum Magum ammunition.
Yeah.
This ammunition is illegal, and Waltney had stated that he did not have any in his possession on the night of the murder. I also believe that this was the same box of ammunition that was later recovered from his home.
Agent Randolph had just proven that George Waltney had lied.
So we knew that he had lied during both trials. Now we wanted to see if he had lied about something else.
Working closely with the Santa Bernardino Sheriff's Office and the California State Patrol, Agent Randolph re-examined all the evidence presented during both trials.
Rather than treating this case as a normal criminal investigation, we took a broader approach. Much like we would do a TWA Flight 800 check. Examining every single screw and rivet.
The mountain of reports, transcripts, photographs, and physical evidence was examined one by one by FBI lab experts and agents from the field offices.
We sent back to the lab key elements such as the frame of the gun. The frame had been collected by the police, and they had analyzed the tool marks. They had not been able to determine who had dismantled it.
The frame was sent to the FBI lab experts in Washington. This lab is unique in the world. It houses a collection of 2,000 firearms, from John Dinger's pistol to the latest military assault rifles. It also houses samples of every projectile in existence for the last 50 years. Like the weapons, these bullets are used for analysis and comparisons. The experts use the soundproof room of the ballistics department to fire and collect the projectiles. They also use stereoscopes to examine the barrels of the firearms. But the lab's greatest asset is undoubtedly its experienced specialists who are used to cases as complex as the Bishop murder. Jim Cadigan of the FBI's Firearms and Toolmarks Division was called in to conduct an analysis of the firearms frame and the 15 tools collected from Waltney's home. Steel tools almost always leave distinct microscopic marks when used. These marks are as unique as a fingerprint. The FBI's tool mark analysis lab is one of the largest and most sophisticated in the world.
From the outset, it was obvious that the person who disassembled this firearm was familiar with forensics. They had taken care to remove all the pieces of teardrop metal that could be examined by an expert.
Agent Cadigan began his analysis. His goal, to link the tool marks on the firearm to the 15 tools collected from Waltney's home.
The basic question was whether one of these tools had been used to hold the receiver while the barrel was being removed.
On examining it,
I noted a small mark, about 1.5 millimeters, near the point where a rod holds the barrel. It looked as if it were the mark of the tip of a small screwdriver that was there, under this hole.
The mark had the same slight imperfection as one of Gaultney's tools.
On examining Guat's tools, I noticed on a wrench that one tooth had been broken off in the middle and that some metal remained. This resembled the mark left on the weapon. Based on this evidence, I began to make marks with this wrench. On examination under a microscope, I was able to conclude that it was this wrench that had been used to create the marks found on the weapon.
In addition to tool mark analysis, the FBI lab conducted other tests on the bullets collected from Gaultney's home. The absence of the barrel of Gaultney's gun made ballistics analysis impossible, and that was what had hurt the prosecutor the most during both trials. The FBI then decided to create a new type of analysis. It was the first time nuclear technology had been used in forensics.
When a lead manufacturer like Remington Arms makes a batch of lead, it mixes the different elements together much like you do when you make a pie. So each batch is unique. We had collected about 200 bullets from George Michael Gaultney during the investigation. We submitted them to the lab. We then made them radioactive in order to obtain their molecular weights, their chemical fingerprints, and uncut. We discovered that the lead in 27 bullets was identical to that of the bullet that had killed the victim.
The samples in the reactor absorb neutrons and become radioactive. This radioactivity is then measured and provides a precise reading of the chemical elements of lead. It is, in a way, its atomic fingerprint. The radioactive analyses were indisputable. The 27 projectiles collected from Gaultney's closet, a projectile he had sworn not to have in his possession, came from the same batch as the one that had killed Robin Bishop. Analysts at the FBI lab had finally linked the remains of Gaultney's gun to his wrench, as well as the fatal projectile to those collected from his home. Agent Randolph then had psychological profiles drawn up on George Gaultney and Robin Bishop. It was essential for the jury to understand that she had been a victim. Robin Bishop had been raped by someone she should respect and trust, a law enforcement officer.
This allowed us to illustrate why there had been no evidence of struggle or violence at the crime scene other than the murder itself. She complied. She respected the authority of a police officer. She was the kind of person who would pull over, show her ID, get out of her car, and allow herself to be handcuffed. Even if all she had done was get a speeding ticket, it was easy to victimize her.
FBI experts then looked into Gaultney's past to understand his behavior toward women. They interviewed one of his former mistresses. She would meet him at the same secluded location each time to have sex. The location was on the same driveway where Robin Bishop had driven. They listed all the women Gaultney had ticketed over the past 2 years. A pattern began to emerge. More than a dozen women said Gaultney had made sexual advances or touched them suggestively.
This indicated that sexual assault was not an isolated incident for Gaultney. That was his usual behavior. We concluded that when he wore his uniform, he became a kind of predator.
The testimony from both trials was also carefully examined. It was hoped that contradictions would be found. In some cases, the authority of the FBI made things easier. The stubbornness of the FBI agents was beneficial in the Gwaltney case. Detectives from the San Bernardino Police Department had interviewed the owners of the Barstow gun shops to show that the officer had tried to buy a replacement barrel for his revolver the day after the crime. They all said they had not seen him. One of them was William Haddington. His business was called the Powder Horn. During both trials, he had claimed that George Gwaltney had not come to his shop the day after the murder. But his phone records proved that he was lying. We found documents indicating that the day after the murder, after the meeting Gwaltney had attended, Mr. Haddington had called his Sacramento branch to order a barrel for a gun of the same model as Gwaltney sold you. When FBI agents showed Haddington this information, he admitted that Gwaltney had been welcomed to his business to purchase a barrel the day after Robin Bishop's murder.
I'm late.
In reconstructing the events, the FBI also discovered that Gwaltney had created a false alibi to cover up his visit to the gunsmith and shoe repair shop where he had his holster refinished. He had claimed to be on duty that day. Gwaltney's statements fell apart, but the most important part of the reconstruction was the episode in which young Preston Olsen was driven home. The problem was that no detective had thought to discuss this seriously with Preston Olsen. He had testified at both trials and had corroborated Gwaltney's statements.
But as they reviewed the events minute by minute with Preston and his mother, they realized that Officer Gwaltney had actually dropped the boy off 30 minutes earlier than he had stated in his initial testimony. This new information and the resulting reconstruction were very important to the investigation.
He could no longer change the facts. He had made the same statements at both trials. So the reconstruction of events was very important. It gave us a 30-minute period for which we had never obtained a transcript.
So Officer Gwaltney had 20 to 40 minutes to arrest Bishop, handcuff her, force her to have sex, and then kill her. How to say? Edward Blake was called in to re-examine the semen that had been presented as evidence at both trials. It was problematic to present this type of evidence before the development of DNA analysis. Still, FBI agents hoped to find a way to present this evidence. Gwaltney had undergone a vasectomy and then had a second procedure to restore his former condition. Was there any way to use this information to prove that the semen collected at the crime scene was his? The prosecutor asked the serologist Edward Blake if there was any scientific advance that might help the investigation.
He said to me, "Science is advancing rapidly, isn't it, Dr. Blake? Perhaps there is something you could look at that would be relevant to our case." I told him that I knew fertility specialists. One of the important pieces of information was that Gwaltney had undergone a vasectomy and then had it reversed.
Blake later learned from his colleagues at the University of California that this second procedure sometimes causes the production of anti-sperm antibodies. The body reacts to semen entering the bloodstream as if it were germs. Since this phenomenon is quite rare, it could perhaps be used to identify seminal fluid. So samples of Gwaltney's semen were sent to the University of California lab.
Not only did we discover that the fluids contained antibodies, but they were also found to be in high concentrations. This gave us the information that allowed us to delve even deeper into our analysis.
Blake then learned of a new fertility test. This test measured the presence of antibodies in samples collected at the crime scene.
We prepared samples from
The semen found on Robin Bishop's jeans and the one collected from the back seat of the police car. These samples were analyzed and the same antibodies were found in both cases.
During the FBI's 6-month investigation, all the evidence that had been re-examined and all the new testimony allowed the agents involved in the case to reach the certainty of Waltney's guilt.
We knew we had the guilty party and that we were finally going to win.
Waltney would appear in court again. George Michael Gaultney was charged with violating Robin Bishop's civil rights and was placed under arrest. He was the first California police officer to be charged under federal civil rights law. Again, he pleaded not guilty. But for the first time since Robin Bishop's death, the girl's parents were hopeful that the trial would not have the same outcome. This time, George Gaultney was in federal court, facing the FBI. This process would certainly be different from the first two. The trial began on January 17, 1984, in the U.S. District Court in Los Angeles. George Gaultney was represented by attorney Carol Douglas, who had decided not to call her client to testify because the officer was in a bad situation.
Gaultney knew that we had destroyed his alibis, his statements, and that he had to come up with something.
Yeah.
He had blocked all his own paths, and we fully intended to use this situation to send him to prison.
As the trial progressed, the FBI destroyed every argument Gaultney had made. The prosecutor told the jury that Gaultney had spotted his prey when he first saw her at the restaurant. With the testimony of the other women who had attacked him, the officer's impeccable image was shattered. After driving Preston Olson home, he had ordered Bishop to pull over and get into his police car. The new testimony showed that he had had plenty of time to do so. Then, as he had done to Mace, he drove her to a secluded area and forced her to have sex with him. Semen on the back seat and in the victim's jeans corroborated this. As she sat there trying to put her boots back on, Agent Kaufman's bright spotlight shone on Gaultney, proving that he had indeed been in the driveway with Robin Bishop. Unaware that he had lit the gun and had been recognized, he panicked and killed Robin Bishop. Then, still shaken, he called the police station to report a suicide.
The autopsy.
And crime scene photos proved that he had not moved her head while taking her thumb. The displacement was too great. He desperately searched for the bullet that had killed him. He would then try to cover up his crime through a series of actions. That same evening, Waltney removed the barrel of the murder weapon, leaving microscopic marks that were consistent with one of these tools. But the semen analysis was probably the most convincing evidence presented in court. Small beads could be seen clumping together with the semen from the victim's jeans and the back seat.
What could be seen on this recording was the final analysis of the samples that contained the antibodies.
Clearly, sperm could be seen swimming and the beads clumped together, indicating that antibodies were present in both samples. The judge only allowed Edward Blake to give the results of his tests in percentages. Blake stated that Gaultney's blood type was the same as 12% of the population, Of that 12%, antibodies were found in only 5% of the subjects. Less than 1% of the male population could have had sexual intercourse with Robin Bishop that evening. Although the defense argued that the evidence was circumstantial, the scientific analysis was too convincing. The jury quickly reached a verdict.
When the jurors returned, none of them looked at Gold Knee. It was obvious that they had found him guilty.
As for me, I was happy to know that George was finally going to pay for his crime, and that we knew why Robin Bishop died.
It was an investigation I will never forget.
UE right to the harshest sentence possible. 90 years in federal prison and a minimum of 30 years before being eligible for parole. 12 years later, Waltney died in prison from a heart attack. Until the end, he maintained that he was innocent and had been the victim of a conspiracy.